DJ Shrimp Chips popping back in real quick to let folks know that MSG will actually not be on air next week because of a special program called Active Voice, which will be a single day broadcast takeover that will acknowledge and address the dire political circumstances of the moment. Shout out Miguel, who's standing next to me, and the entire KFEI staff for making these really important conversations happen. And yeah, keep the dial where it is for Right on Radio.
You're listening to KFAI on 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and streaming on the web at kfai.org. Welcome to Right on Radio.
All right. Hi, folks. Today on Right on Radio, I have David Hakenson and their new book, Her Place in the Woods, The Life of Helen Hoover. Thank you so much for joining us today, David.
I'm happy to be here, Emma. Thank you.
Awesome. So what I wanted to know about is, what made you think about writing about Helen Hoover's biography? What was like the thought process behind that?
Yeah, interesting question, because I've been asked that by a lot of my friends. Helen Hoover was this sort of beloved nature writer who lived up on Gunflint Lake in the 1950s and 60s. And she was quite successful, best-selling, wrote four books for the adult market and three for the juvenile market. And at the time, they were all bestsellers. People knew of her. But in the years since then, and since she moved away from Gunflint Lake, her reputation is sort of diminished. And I was looking around after reading her books for a biography, thinking I might find one, and didn't. So I started looking around thinking, there's got to be more about this woman. And I discovered some material at the Minnesota Historical Society that pointed me to UMD, where her papers were in their archives and special collections. So I took a dive into all of that and was convinced that her story was very interesting and needed to be told.
Awesome. So the kind of follow-up question is, like, when you went up to the, how was the research for this? Like, was it pretty easy to go to the UMD market? Were there any other sources you were looking for while looking into her biography?
Yeah, there were a lot of interesting sources. UMD obviously was the primary resource because her papers are there. But what first got me pointed in that direction was this paper at the History Center in St. Paul. And it was a master's thesis that this woman had written for her MFA at Hamline University. And she was in her 60s when she wrote it. She had passed away. I tracked down her daughter through her obituary just to see if they had donated her research to a library in woman said to me, her daughter said to me, we I still have all the research and I'd be happy to let you take a look at it. So I had that. I had what was at UMD. And then from there, it was a matter of pulling in things that I learned about from the UMD collection, which was her publisher was Alfred Knopf, well-known publishing company. All of their corporate papers were in the Ransom Center at the University of Texas at Austin. And so I was able to get a lot of material from that related to her. And then she had some correspondence with some other writers, and one in particular was a science fiction writer who had donated all of her papers to Syracuse University. And they had all of Helen's correspondence with this author in their collection. So I was really able to sort of pull together this mosaic of information to pull from.
Cool. From those, for like somebody like me, I didn't know much about Helen Hoover at all. I was born in 95, so way past that demographic. And like my introduction to, I want to say like maybe 60s environmentalism is mostly through Rachel Carson in Silent Spring. I'm from Pittsburgh, so like she also went to school there. She has a bridge named after her. So like that's my introduction to that era of environmentalism. And Helen Hoover was just, I don't even know if that was an option until like I moved here or like read about the book. So I'm curious. You've mentioned I do believe like you read all of her books. When you were reading her books and then doing the biography, what was like the most exciting thing about that? Did you find like, oh, this is what she was writing about, or like more insights to her writing style while doing the biography?
Yes, and the fact that you mentioned Rachel Carson is interesting because they didn't necessarily know about each other, but Helen was certainly aware of Carson, who wouldn't be because she wrote Silent Spring, and that was sort of a seminal book that launched the whole environmental movement in this country. And that was in 1962. Helen, when she had first moved up to Gunflint Lake in 1954, she had been a scientist in Chicago, and she really was not happy that the county sprayed the side roads with DDT to kill the grass and to keep the weeds down. So she would complain to the county officials through letters to the editor in the Cook County News Herald in Grand Marais about this. And she also wrote to legislators and also the Department of Conservation, which is what it was called then, and even to her congressman complaining about this, and got some of the spraying to be stopped. And so she was aware, she read the Scientific American, she read some other journals like that. So she was very much on top of what Rachel Carson was doing. But to your question about her writing style, because she had been a scientist and because she loved to write, she had a very good observational powers and the ability for patience. And she had plenty of time to sit in her cabin and watch animals outside their door that they fed with bird seed and other things, and just kind of watch their environment and observe it, and then start to write about the things that she learned. And it wasn't only just looking at things. She got reference books and other things which helped inform her about animal behavior, and that all sort of influenced her writing. So it was very much a I'm going to tell you about what I saw and what I observed. And I'm also going to remind you that man can't control nature. We have to coexist with it. And that sort of message comes through in all of her books for the adult market, which are each one are a little bit different.
Yeah, and like kind of elaborating on the writing style, what I found fascinating while reading the book was she would anthropomorphize her animals, like Peter the Buck. And I don't know of any contemporary natural scientist who does that. And I wonder if you can elaborate to our listeners more why she did that and kind of how that was different from her contemporaries at the time.
Yeah, and that was particularly from the book The Gift of the Deer, which was her second book published in 1966. And she took that accusation about anthropomorphizing her books very personally and didn't agree with it. I think part of it with The Gift of the Deer, she named all of these deer. And I think people thought that that was sort of, a little bit too sentimental. But when you're trying to describe deer to a reader, you can't say deer number one, deer number two, deer number three. You have to give them names, so, or some way of, ascribing who they are. So she did that. But I think what was important is that if you read between the lines on that particular book and others, She still gets at the core of their animal behavior and observes it and tries to interpret it for humans. And she goes up to that line where, some writers will say that, an animal did something like this that we think about in human terms, but there's no way that they can behave that way because they're not humans. She kind of went up to that line, and I think she masked her ability not to cross it by perhaps just explaining what she saw rather than editorializing on what she saw. So she did get some criticism for it, but she also had her editor who didn't agree with that and asked her to write about that in her third book, which she did in the foreword. And she sort of beat back her critics about that particular topic.
I never thought about that. One of the things I really like kind of resonated with her story was a woman being in a male-dominated environment, especially being in the metallurgist, I believe is how
Yes,
the
that's correct.
And I'm kind of curious, when doing the biography, writing the biography, did she have like any of like extraordinary insights on being in a male-dominated environment that our listeners would like to know, and like kind of how that shaped her personality and her perseverance?
Yes, I think that's a great question. I think looking back at it, when you look at sort of the birth of the feminism movement, which was often attributed to Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique in 1964, Helen had been working in metallurgy, which is not a women's field at all. It's the study of understanding different properties in metals. And she was working at International Harvester, a big farm implement company. And actually during World War II, she had a series of jobs at testing labs where she learned a lot and was self-taught because she didn't have a college degree. She had only gone to college for 2 years. And I think that, and then landing this really plum job at International Harvester and dealing with this particular problem they had with how steel was treated, and she solved it and had got a patent for the research that she did. I think that was very unusual for the time. And I think because she had a high IQ, even though she wasn't formally tested, it's very apparent through some of her correspondence and some of her self-awareness that she had a high IQ, that she just was not, she just was not aware of, sort of the conflicts. And she was sort of above it all, even though the fact that she knew that she was not liked because she didn't have a college degree or an advanced degree, or that she was smart and that she solved this problem, and that she had men and colleagues along the way putting up various roadblocks and ways to sort of sabotage her career, if you will. And once she had solved this problem and got the patent, she felt like she'd accomplished all she wanted to do. And she quit and walked away from that job and decided to move up to Gunflint Lake with her husband and start another career, hopefully, writing. And at the beginning, it was difficult. She started with magazine work and then children's writing. And then it morphed into getting contracts to do books. And she had a really successful second career.
What I really like is also the collaboration with her husband, who was the illustrator for those books, correct?
That's correct. Adrian, I illustrated all of her books.
I think that's just such a cute, that's just a cute couple story. That's like to me ideal couples goals.
Well, it was interesting because when they first moved up there, he was supposed to get a contract to do artwork by mail with a client in Chicago. And what happened was they had a car accident. He couldn't get to the appointment in Duluth. He lost the contract, and then they were sort of stuck to figure out what to do. And Helen came up with the idea, because he was an artist, that he could do things like note paper and stationery that they could sell, that they could produce and sell to like gift shops and others up in that area of the state. And then eventually she placed an ad in one of the nature magazines, Audubon, to sell the stationery. So what they essentially did was ran a mail order business out of their house. And the other thing was is that the way they reproduced the art on note paper is that it was done on a mimeograph, and you have to be a certain age to remember what a mimeograph is, but it's a duplicating device and it doesn't require electricity, which they did not have at the cabin. It's done by a hand cranking process. So they were able to do that work by hand without electricity and make a living until, and then at the same time, Helen discovered that she was really adept at writing short stories about animals in the woods near their cabin and in their yard. And she started submitting those to nature magazines, and they started paying her $35 and $50 a throw. And they started to sort of, Adrian had his job and she had hers, and they were both really, really successful with that.
Yeah, I want to touch base on what you mentioned about the lack of electricity in the cabin. I'm kind of curious, how was it writing the biography and learning the hardships of cabin ownership in where they didn't have electricity or running water? And it didn't sound like Helen had a lot of experience experience with this sort of kind of environment. And I wonder if you can elaborate that with our listeners.
Yes, it is interesting. They bought the cabin in 1948 and they spent several summers going up to it, like a lot of people do, spending their 2 week summer at the cabin. When they decided to move there permanently, what they hadn't thought about is you're going to have to live there year round. And they'd never been there in the late fall or winter. So they didn't really think through what they were getting into. And it didn't have running water. They pulled their water out of Gunflint Lake and brought it up to the cabin in buckets. They didn't have electricity. At the beginning, they had an electric plant. It was like a wind generator, but it worked intermittently and then it eventually didn't work. They did have an oil burning furnace, a small one, and a cook stove, but neither one of them were capable of keeping the house warm all winter at the types of temperatures that you find up at the end of the Gunflint Trail. So, and they also didn't hunt and they didn't fish. So they weren't able to, eat fish or shoot deer and live off of that because it just was against their principles. So they really were kind of in really naive about what it was going to take to live there. And they encountered a lot of challenges. They had help from some of the neighbors and friends there, but having been two people who lived through the Depression in the 1930s, a lot of people then couldn't rely on anybody for help. There just wasn't help. You had to bootstrap yourself and take care of yourself. And I think part of that sort of survival mentality that they had from the years of the Depression, which were difficult for both of them before they got married, sort of carried over into their life up in the North Woods.
Yeah, I also want to when you mentioned about like working with, because they didn't take any hunted goods, or like they didn't hunt or fish. And I remember reading in the book, Helen had as like some confrontations with like the local hunters and around that area. I was wondering if you can like expand upon why that was, and just like kind of the contention that she had with like the local community initially when her and her husband moved up there.
Yeah, they I think one of the things is they started to feed deer and other animals, and the deer would come back, and I don't want to say they were domesticated, but they certainly were going to go where there was a food source. And they did this over several years, and I think Helen talked about it with some of her neighbors. And then the lodges and resorts nearby, which catered to deer hunters in the fall before they closed for the season, certainly were keen on the fact that Helen was feeding all these deer and they were fattening them up. And they had no compunction about saying that there were deer in the area that were being fed by somebody locally. I think what Helen and rightly so was angry about is that their property was posted, not, no trespassing and no hunting. And hunters just, didn't pay any attention to that and went on their land to shoot. It was more of a Wild West mindset back in those days than it is today. It was far north on the Gunflint Trail. It wasn't nearly as developed. So I just think there was less mental restrictions on where people went to hunt. I just think they kind of thought it was the North Woods and everything's fair game. And so when they came onto their property and shot some of the deer that Helen had been writing about, she was very distressed by that and it really upset her. And really, the fact that so many of the deer that they fed that were featured in the book were eventually shot and killed was really the impetus for her to put that story to paper and write it. And she wanted to do it in a way that, that sort of honored and memorialized the deer in that book.
Huh, that's pretty interesting, because I thought yeah, and especially like the way she immortalized it with like naming the deer, because it always does feel like it's kind of a childish thing to like name like your backyard rabbits, gophers. There's a raccoon that lives in my backyard and I just like calling him, I think, oh God, I think his name changes every month or so. But it does make it kind of fun though. It's like, okay, there's Glenn again, I guess. I always find that really interesting. But I was going to like kind of bring us back into modern times with Helen Hoover's writing. I'm wondering like what can modern audiences, or for those like in my generation, I did not grow up with Helen Hoover. What can we take away from her writing, especially now currently with environmentalism as a more of a upstanding issue now than it was then?
Yeah. Well, I think one of the things that's interesting about nature writing in general is that it doesn't age. We still read Thoreau's Walden, you know, and that was written, you know, what, a couple hundred years ago. And subsequent to that, there's been other nature writers, John Muir, Sigurd Olsen from Minnesota. There's others that have written about it. Nature never goes out of style. It doesn't change, other than, you know, we are impacted by things like climate change and those sorts of things. But you can still write an observation about deer today, or in 1950 when Helen wrote about it, or in 1825 when Jack London wrote about it. So I think you can, I think the thing about Helen that's good is this sort of through line that's sort of in between the stories she tells about being very, very clear that man cannot control nature, and we never will be able to do that. And we need to coexist with animals and their environment and our environment in a way that preserves it for the future. So I think if you read her that way, you will find her still relevant, even though there's some nostalgic aspects to not having electricity or running water and things like that.
Yeah, because it's always kind of sometimes I do feel I'm mostly an urban city dweller. So when I always read stories of folks like up in the cabin or things like that, I just never really I sometimes it doesn't feel like it clicks, but I always really like reading the stories of nature writers because it does transport me into those areas and that kind of mindset that makes it easier for me to digest nature writing, quite frankly. That's kind of the thing I always find interesting. Mine of my question, because it's kind of a fun question. Was there a particularly particular book of Helen that you found that you really liked? Of her four books that she wrote for mostly adults? Is
I
one?
think the one that sparked the most was her third book, A Place in the Woods. And that's really the story, the first of her four books that's more autobiographical. And what it does is it tells the story of them wanting to find a cabin in the North Woods and traveling all over Wisconsin and Upper Michigan and then finally Minnesota and then buying it and then all the things that I've talked about that they just didn't anticipate. And she does it in a self-deprecating way. So you, as a reader like yourself, who's only an urban dweller, like they were, can kind of, you know, understand where she's coming from. Because I think all of us as humans have a fantasy, you know, that we'd like to just walk away from our jobs and go live in a cabin or go sit on a beach or do something and not have to deal with the modern world and all the challenges that come with it. So I think that book really captures sort of her style and storytelling and nature observation in a way that is really captivating.
I always find it because it does like her life just sounds like basically my fantasy of like, yeah, I'll just quit my job and go live in a cabin in the woods. And it's like, I cannot believe somebody actually just basically did
Yeah,
that.
and I think that's a big part of her appeal is that she and her husband walked away from two very well-paying jobs in Chicago, big city, and did what a lot of people fantasize about doing. And they did it successfully, which I think makes the stories obviously a lot more interesting.
What I'm kind of curious of is what is up, is her cabin still available like for tourism up in the Gunflint Lake, or is there still like kind of a tourism economy around her in that
There
area?
really isn't. I think this book is going to spark one, to be honest, because there's a lot of people I encountered that have, you know, vaguely remember her or know of her from local folklore. But, you know, the cabins, one of them had to get torn down. Another one has been heavily modified and they're in private ownership. So there's really not any way to see them. But she definitely, is sparked some interest. I was just up talking at the Chickwack Nature Center recently, and there was about 60 people there, and all of them had heard of Helen or knew about her, but hadn't really understood her context in the times that she lived. So that seems to be something that's sort of sparking a reawakening in her in interest in her writing.
Okay, that's perfect. I'm gonna wrap it up here, David. Do you mind reading a little bit of the book? It's from
Yeah,
the last bit of the novel, and David's gonna read us a bit of a section.
thank you. This is from the last chapter of the book. Helen had said she wanted to lead three lives, one in a bucolic small town where she grew up, another in an urban environment where her mind would be challenged by work, and finally one in a place of peace and solitude where she could write. She accomplished all of these and so much more in the process, carving out her own unique niche among nature writers. She had the ability to connect with her readers in a natural way, and her books were bestsellers in the genre. Reader's Digest would not have purchased the rights to three of her books if she had not have this special appeal. In a sense, her books captured the spirit of the nascent 1960s environmental movement that was stirred by Rachel Carson, which led to a broader desire for a back-to-the-land sensibility fed by a society yearning to be more connected to nature and removed from the challenges of modern life. Helen's professional life as a metallurgist always had its challenges, especially as a woman working in a field dominated by men. One can imagine how odd it must have been in the 1950s endeavoring to fix a disc harrow problem that had vexed a large agricultural implement company for decades, a problem eventually solved by Helen, a woman, self-trained and without a college degree, and achieved a patent for her discovery. That alone would have been the pinnacle of most careers. But for Helen, it was not. The dream of that young girl in Greenfield, Ohio, to live where she wanted and not be bothered while she read and wrote about what she saw, came true. As she said so eloquently in the last paragraph of her final book, The Years of the Forest, "I knew that I had found what all men seek, my place in the world of my time."
Oh, thank you so much for that reading, David. This was David Hakenson with Her Place in the Woods, The Life of Helen Hoover. And David, you will be at Majors and Quinn Booksellers Tuesday, September 30th, correct?
That's correct, at 7 p.m.
Awesome. So catch David at Majors and Quinn, 7 p.m., September 30th. I believe that will be next week. And thank you so much for joining Right on Radio. And now this.
Support for KFAI comes from Crooner Supper Club, presenting Martin Zeller and the Hardways, Saturday, February 7th. Martin Zeller and the Hardways take the main stage showroom by storm for this Americana roots rocking performance. From his solo work to his work with the Gear Daddies to his work with the Hardways, Martin Zeller always delivers his real-life voice to his real-life songs with real-life lyrics. More information about Martin Zeller and the Hardways is available at croonersmn.com.
With a library card, you can access library resources without leaving the home, on your phone, tablet, or computer. Services include online tutoring for kids grades K through 12, job skills, newspapers in multiple languages, and more. Trusted information, learning, and support is available anytime, wherever you are. Learn more at your local library's website or MELSA, MELSA.org, to get started.
Support for KFAI comes from First Avenue, presenting the McNasty Brass Band at the Turf Club, Saturday, January 31st. Fat Tuesday comes early when the McNasty Brass Band brings the Minneapolis sound to the spirit of New Orleans. It's high-energy, up-tempo brass and percussion with a little old-school funk and a splash of R&B thrown in for good measure. More information about the McNasty Brass Band Live at the Turf Club is available at first-avenue.com.
Seward Cafe is the longest-running, worker-owned and operated restaurant in the United States, serving up coffee and vegetarian and vegan food every Thursday through Sunday, 8 a.m. to 4 p.m., located at 2129 East Franklin Avenue in Minneapolis. Seward Cafe, no bosses since 1974.
Support for KFAI comes from the Cedar Cultural Center, presenting Ye Vagabonds, Monday, February 9th. Hailing from Dublin, Ye Vagabonds perform folk music inspired by Irish tradition, with touches of Appalachian and 60s folk. They're touring with their latest release, Nine Waves, a blending of traditional Irish ballads and original songs, displaying their multi-instrumental skills and tight harmonies. Opening the show is Red Thread. More information about Ye Vagabonds is available at thecedar.org.
Support for KFAI comes from The Dakota, presenting Hamilton de Holanda, Monday, January 26th. Brazilian bandolimist Hamilton de Holanda brings his 40 albums and counting career to the Dakota stage. He blends jazz and bossa nova with choro, the street music of Brasilia. Known for his improvisations and stage presence, Hamilton de Holanda has worked with some of the biggest names in jazz for over 40 years. More information about Hamilton de Holanda at the Dakota can be found at dakotacooks.com.
Fresh Air Community Radio with 42 years of quality programming. For your listening pleasure, the following program was recorded earlier for broadcast at this time.
All right. Hi, folks. My name is Emma. Here in the studio today, I have Kristen Stawell, the lyricist and composer, and Maria Bartholdi, the playwright and lyricist, for Endometriosis, the musical, which is currently playing at Theater and Around, which is right across the street from our KFAI studio. Welcome to the show, Kristen and Maria.
Thank you for having us.
Yay. All right. So, just a couple of questions. Can you give me a definition of what is endometriosis for our listeners on the air?
We sure can. Endometriosis is, it gets its name from endometrial tissue, which is tissue found in the uterus. But endometriosis is when tissue that is similar to that type of tissue grows elsewhere in the body. So it's a full body disease. It's not just a reproductive disease. It can grow anywhere. It has been found in the brain, on eyeballs, in, you know, commonly in lungs or diaphragm, most commonly in the abdomen, in the pelvis, that sort of area. But it can be anywhere. It's an inflammatory disease that the cause is unknown. The cure is unknown. Right now, the gold standard treatment is excision surgery. And after you get, you know, disease excised, you could need to have that again later on, maybe not. There's just a lot that's not known about it yet. Maria, anything else to add?
Oh yeah. I mean, it's a very common disease. It affects 1 in 10 people who menstruate, which is about 200 million people worldwide. And the truth is, not a lot of people know what endometriosis is. Most people haven't even heard the word. And the medical community, the research community, it's like severely underfunded and under-researched and under-known, quite frankly, by a lot of people, include the medical community included. So that's one of the things we were trying to do with this musical that we wrote, was try to raise awareness about the disease. It manifests so differently for lots of people who have it. So for some people, they might have these types of symptoms. For some people, they might have completely different symptoms, but they all have endometriosis. So the hallmark symptom is excruciatingly painful periods, but not everybody has that. Both Kristen and I have endometriosis. For me, it manifested that way, pelvic pain, the fact that I got sore sitting in chairs for more than 30 minutes, because it can affect pain in your legs, pain in my ankles, fatigue, sensitive, like getting sick all the time because your nervous system is just overloaded with inflammation, that kind of thing. So it's very tricky, right? It's different for everybody, but it can be very debilitating. And it takes on average 12 years to be diagnosed and 7 doctors, which for me is unacceptable.
Yeah. All right. So I'm guessing like the big inspiration for this play was because you both have endometriosis. Is that correct? Did I misheard that?
No, that is correct. And okay. We had been wanting to collaborate on a project, and Maria actually didn't know she had endometriosis until a few months ago. She was finally diagnosed. That kind of just is, you know, she first went to the doctor for painful periods 27 years ago. So that's kind of tells you, I just have a lot of passion about this because it is so common. I think when someone goes to the doctor with that symptom, that should be the first thing they think it is. And it shouldn't take more than one visit to, you know, investigate that. But 27 years later, Maria's now diagnosed with endometriosis and is learning exactly how much it's infiltrated her life and the things she could do.
What's interesting too is, I sorry just to interrupt for a second, is that like not only is it do a lot of people who have this disease not get support from the medical community when we raise our voices about it, but also I was gaslighting myself about it, right? Because we're taught from such a young age that it's totally normal to have painful periods, right? To just like suffer for a week out of the month and have it impact your life, when honestly that's not normal, and you deserve to live a pain-free productive life without something like your period completely setting you back every single month. So I just wanted to add that, like, you know, it's just ingrained in us culturally, I think, to accept this as women when we really shouldn't have to. Okay, go on, Kristen.
Oh, yeah. To answer your question, why did we write this musical? all of those things to, you know, we want to educate, we want to be advocates. We want, you know, when I was first diagnosed 8 years ago now, I had a lot of stories of going to the doctor, and I would talk to other women, and everyone, no matter what they were dealing with, had similar stories of just kind of maybe being dismissed or not taken too seriously or not offered pain management, you know, just things like that, that it's kind of a typical woman's experience at the doctor, no matter what you're there for. So we thought, wow, this is really actually universal. Like 10% is a lot of the population, but really everyone has experienced this in the healthcare system, whether they have these symptoms or not. So we really want to bring attention to it and, you know, advocate and support people going through this kind of thing.
Yeah, I don't have endometriosis, but I know I do have family members who did. I know a lot of folks with uteruses in my personal family who struggle with PCOS or a lot of anything with that kind of female reproductive organs issues, and the constant doctors, the constant dismissal, and just like, oh, you know, it's just your period. You have to tolerate it. You have to just endure it. That's what I really liked about this musical was it mentions it. It's just not something I've ever heard of in terms of like a play, a musical, or even a piece of media. I'm just curious, how did you two end up meeting in general?
We met in the first grade. We've been best friends our whole lives. Did Brownie Scouts together, and you know, from then on, have been creating stuff together. We had a garage band in middle school. And high school. We did, gosh, I don't know, so many different creative projects together. There was a local TV station in our town, and I remember Maria's mom would rent a video camera from there, and we would make a home video, like what we thought were very professional home videos. And
oh, they were.
We've always been making stuff together, sometimes musical, sometimes theatrical. And now as adults, this is our first project that we've been pursuing together.
Awesome. So can you just give us an overview of the tone and vibe of the musical for those who missed it at Fringe a couple of years ago? For those who haven't yet to see it live.
Oh my gosh, yes. So I think, I know we've been talking very serious here in this interview, yeah, but this is a very fun show. I think that we just both, we have a big attachment to comedy in our lives. Like, I'm an improv comedian. Kristen is very, very funny and plays piano for improv groups out in D.C., and I think we just both knew that was where we were going to end up, is like we were just drawn to this topic and making it fun, accessible, and funny, because that's the kind of people we are. And I think, you know, honestly, just if you took this so super seriously, you would just be like, I just can't handle it. It's a horrible, debilitating disease. But when you can't cry anymore about it, you laugh, right? And so the tone of the show is very fun and upbeat. It's an absurdist comedy, so it's extremely silly and dumb. We have songs like called, for example, Dear Aunt Flo. We have people wearing costumes you might not expect at a musical. The show goes in a lot of really weird, zany directions, and we love that about it. The absurdity of the show, I like to say as well, is an interesting mirror to our lead character. Her name is Jane. To her life, I think, because it really does feel absurd if you're a person who has this disease or any disease really, and you found trouble in the medical system, because you know, you're living with this reality that other people refuse to accept. And I think our show, in an interesting way, does that as well, as the reality is absurd around Jane, but her condition and the way she, you know, needs it to be treated with respect and dignity just doesn't happen. And so I like that parallel that we have in the show with the absurdist comedy and the absurdity of people not taking the serious condition seriously.
Awesome. So kind of a follow-up with the Fringe. So it did premiere in Fringe, Minnesota Fringe Festival in 2022, and it was a big hit. It sold out on all five showings, correct?
Oh gosh, I don't know if it sold out on all of them, but it was pretty close if it didn't.
And it did take home, I believe, the venue pick, the audience pick, and the artist pick. And so the Fringe Fest, from my understanding, it was a 45-minute play. And then now what's currently shown at Theater and Around is a 2-hour production with about like a 15-minute intermission. So what was the thought process of going from the Fringe show to the full-fledged production over at Theater and Around? And what was like the creative process? What did you add? What are things you had to cut just kind of elaborate on? How was that creative process?
Yeah, the Fringe, the 2022 Fringe had a 50-minute time limit. So we gave ourselves a 45-minute time limit, hoping people would laugh. Even from the first day of Fringe rehearsal to that production, we cut a lot of stuff. So we already had stuff that we had to cut just for time, like, you know, a full song that had three verses and choruses, maybe just had one verse and chorus in the Fringe version, that sort of thing. So when we always kind of knew we wanted this to have a life beyond Fringe, and we knew we wanted to expand some things. The biggest change is the ending. The Fringe version was really short. The ending, we get to find out like, oh, this is the problem, and it's just kind of, you know, like, hooray. And really that, I think there is a hooray, getting diagnosed with this disease is wonderful, because you know, and you can then, you know, figure out what to do about your symptoms. But the problem with this disease is it's a chronic illness. It's not a take this pill and it's better, or even surgery and it's better. It's, you know, you have to really trial and error, basically. What works for one person, kind of like the symptoms, what works for one person doesn't work for someone else. So there's always different things you have to be trying, and, you know, what your diet, your lifestyle, surgeries, all of that. So we wanted to have an ending that was a little more honest about that. And it is still a good thing to be diagnosed, but what is the reality of now living with this diagnosis? So that's kind of the biggest thing we changed, is we elaborated on that a lot. The Fringe version had 6 actors in it. Now there are 8 actors, so we've added a couple of characters. The ensemble all play multiple characters, so really we've added like 6 or 7 characters with 2 actors. Some of the songs are longer. There are a lot of brand new songs. Some scenes we didn't have time for a song in the Fringe version. Now there's a song and things like that. So I think, you know, it's been 3 years since that Fringe, and we've been working on it that whole time. And we're really happy. Even now, we were meeting the other day and talking about like, okay, here's what we might still want to change. Here's what where we might actually elaborate a little more on this topic or that topic. So we're still, it's just kind of always a work in progress for us, which makes it really exciting. But I think where it is right now does feel final, and like we've landed in a really great place. And if given the opportunity, you know, we'll make changes here and there, but
I don't know. Maria, do you have any other comments to add to that? Or
oh, sure. I'll add that. One thing too is that the show is very timely. So we have a section in the show which was built in specifically to address current events, because we know, you know, when we know that technically the subject matter is rather narrow. We're talking about endometriosis, a very specific disease, but it's also extremely broad because, like Kristen mentioned earlier, there's so many people who have gone to the doctor and been dismissed, or whose problems haven't been taken seriously by their family or their work, their job, and won't give them time off, that kind of stuff. So it is broad in that sense. But we also wanted to address all of the other stuff that is part of the ecosystem of healthcare and marginalized people trying to seek care for their healthcare, which of course is relevant to Jane and her journey, but the show of course focuses on Jane. She's the main character, but we wanted to give a moment to be like, she doesn't exist in a vacuum, right? All of this other stuff is happening around and outside her and to her, and her life is the way it is because of all that as well. So that's something that we're attuned to in the version of the show. Like if you see it now, there you'll know this section that I'm talking about with women who are in a waiting room at a doctor's office. And there's stuff that we had to change, honestly, like 3 days or whatever, I think, before the show had its first performance, because the news is really changing that quickly. And we don't know what's going to happen in the next few months, the next few years, what new horrors await us. But we're happy to, you know, go in there and make those changes, because I think the show just needs to stay up to the moment and relevant with how that stuff is impacting people's lives. And I like that about it, that we are able to take that time and moment and widen out our lens a little bit. We're thankful to Theater in the Round for giving us the opportunity to transform the piece from 45 minutes into the 90-minute version, which was a reading we did at Theater in the Round. Shannon Custer, who directed the show in this production, was our mentor for that and helped us expand the piece from 45 to 90 minutes. It quite honestly, it was one of the hardest things that I personally have ever had to do, because, you know, in my head, even though we wanted a life beyond Fringe, it was like we wrote it for Fringe. So a lot of it felt very fringy to me. And I was like, I'm not sure how to make it. I don't know what the word is to expand it in a way that makes sense for a full scale musical. But that it was also such a wonderful challenge and taught us so much about the show and ourselves as creators. That when we did it, it was just extremely rewarding. And so I'm really proud of where we ended up now with this full length version. But like Kristen said, we were just meeting the other day and I was like, ooh, what if we did X, Y, and Z now? And I think, you know, that's just kind of the truth of this show, is that it's got flexibility in it, because Jane's journey is in a way tied to the world that we live in currently. And I like that I mean, this is the first time we've seen it fully produced, right? So also you're going to see stuff that when you write it on a page, you have no idea really how it's going to be performed by actors on a stage. And so, you know, we have all that wonderful knowledge now too, that we'll be able to use moving forward.
Yeah. Actually one of my questions here is, it's about the current administration, which is very hostile to healthcare for those, especially in marginalized communities. I know when I saw the musical first, I always thought it was like kind of a soft protest and like kind of an affirmation to those who do experience those symptoms, whether or not it's just endometriosis or PCOS. And I kind of almost took the musical as like an emotional validating, especially it is kind of so whimsical. And I do think it is a very important musical for this current time period that we are in. So how do you have any more thoughts on that? Or?
Yeah, I think we can just give a really specific example. The scene Maria was talking about, we had a song in the Fringe version called Birth Control that was really about the over-prescribing of birth control. Like it feels like for many women, you go to the doctor with any symptom related to your period and the answer is hormonal birth control. That'll solve it. And so it's the song was about that and how, you know, these things are not actually helping us. And we were, you know, investigating the musical recently for this production, like what do we want to update? And it feels like currently, the over prescribing of birth control is not the biggest problem with birth control. It felt like, you know, like not having access to it is a way bigger problem. So we reworked that entire scene and song to be a lot more about that, about how birth control is currently, because 3 years ago, it did feel like, oh gosh, now I have to take birth control. And we also feel like birth control is wonderful and we're glad it exists. Like we don't want to suggest that we don't feel like that, but today it feels like, wow, like people can be denied birth control for what I would consider is no reason. And so we want to bring light to that and the kind of dangers around that instead. The song's now called Birth, in parentheses, Control.
Yeah. Yes. Birth Control. I really love puns and plays on words, probably a little too much as somebody who's done some of the lyrics in the show. So I was very proud of myself for putting birth in parentheses and control after it, because the song is really, you know, now more generally about the control of femme people and how, or marginalized people of marginalized genders, and how people outside of us in our own bodies seek to control us through medicine and through, you know, the legal system or whatever. And it really makes me happy to hear that you thought of the show as a protest, because I think of it that way too. So thank you.
Perfect. My next kind of question is, it's a little silly, but do you have any favorite songs that you loved writing or that you thought was like really cathartic? Can you explain more of the creative process? Because I always like talking to lyricists and like how they write and just songs in general.
Well, I'll go first because I really am excited to talk about this. My favorite song in the show is a song called TMI, which did not exist in the Fringe version, but we had kind of a very, very different version that we had written that didn't end up in the Fringe. And so it kind of got sidelined. And when we did the 90-minute version, we're like, well, what if we thought of a way to bring this back? And it's a song that's within a scene that's set in Applebee's where Jane is having dinner with her family. And her family doesn't want to talk about her problems because they're very uncomfortable. And I think as Minnesotans, a lot of us can relate to that sentiment. We have trouble talking about hard things, I think. And so TMI is essentially the family just kind of deflecting and trying not to talk about Jane's problem in any way, shape, or form. So it includes a ton of euphemisms for period. And Kristen lives in Washington, D.C. most of the time. So we collaborate virtually over Zoom and stuff. And for that song, she was here as we were trying to develop the 90-minute version. And we got to write that song together in person. And it was one of the greatest experiences because it just flowed. Like, it was just so easy. I always say I feel like that song was done in 15 minutes. It was probably more than that, but that's what it felt like, because it just came to us like divine inspiration, which is a very funny thing to say if you hear the song, because it is filthy, but which plays to my personal strengths. But I love that song, and it was so easy to write, and it was just a wonderful experience.
Kristen, I agree with that. Writing that song together in person was, it got done really quickly, but also was in danger of never getting done because we were just cracking ourselves up the entire time. Usually our writing process with the songs is I'll probably write something first with what I call nonsense lyrics, really placeholder lyrics, where it's like, okay, I'm too much of a perfectionist. So if I really worry about the lyrics, the song's never going to get done. So I'm like, okay, this is basically what we wanted to say. I send the song to Maria. She writes more lyrics, and then together we refine from there. Or maybe, one of us has thought of lyrics and we've gone back and forth on that before there's music, that sort of thing. But it's really a back and forth. So to be doing it together at the same time was really fun and special, especially for that song, which is just so comedic and absurd, that to have that interaction made it, so much easier to write than just to be on our own and then getting feedback afterwards. Because I'm a perfectionist, I also don't mind working alone sometimes, so I can go very, very slowly. my favorite song in the show, I don't know. There's a song, Theater in the Round wanted an intermission, and we hadn't really built the show for that. And we're like, oh, okay, so where the intermission falls naturally, there's a great place for it. But kind of the next scene is not super upbeat. We're like, we want a splashier act two opener. So we wrote a new act two opener. And I think honestly, whatever song we wrote most recently is my favorite. And that's the one we wrote most recently.
I love that.
Yes, but that we had originally, written a few different songs to open the show. And where we landed one, we ended up refining, and we got exactly where we wanted. But that means that a song that we really liked wasn't in the show anymore, just because there wasn't a place for it. So we got to put a little bit of it in the act two opener. And I'm really quite pleased with that.
Oh yeah, it's great. You gotta see the act two opening. It might be one of my favorite moments of the show itself.
All right. I just have one more question, and it is, where would you like to see the play go once its final run's going to be coming up pretty soon, towards the middle of July? Where would you want to take this musical?
Was Broadway.
Broadway.
That's a great question. And I think we don't totally know the answer. One of, like I said before, one of our goals with the show is advocacy and education. And so we do want it to have more of a life, and we want it, you know, to speak to more people than just the people of Minneapolis. But yeah, Theater in the Round has been so supportive of us, and we are so grateful to be doing the world premiere at that show with those specific people. Like, we love everyone there. We love the cast, the director, the musicians. We're so happy with this production. And I think we're, you know, what's next is a little up in the air right now. I think we both know, like, little things that we're like, okay, I want to add this or change that. And that's really exciting. So figuring out the right venue to do those sort of things in, I think, is part of the adventure.
Yeah, I would love to see this show produced again. I don't want this to be the end for it. I think it's, you know, it suffers from the fact that I think a lot of people are turned off by the idea of seeing a show that's quote unquote for women, that's quote unquote about a disease or whatever. So it does have that hurdle to jump that, for instance, Oklahoma might not have. But I feel like once people get past that and actually see the show, they understand that it is a universal experience. It is really, really funny. Like, a lot of people tell me they're just crying when they're laughing during the show, which makes me so happy. The songs are incredible. I just want people to understand and get past that initial barrier and give the show a chance. And I think when they do, they find out they really love it. So I'd love to see it put up on its feet somewhere again and again, quite honestly.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Kristen and Maria, for joining us in at KFAI 90.3 FM. Endometriosis the Musical runs through July 13th with performances Fridays and Saturdays at 7:30 p.m. and Sundays at 2 p.m., a special Thursday performance on July 10th, and a Pay What You Can night on Monday, June 30th. Tickets can be found on the website at theaterintheround.org.